This is Eitan Weinstein.
And I'm Naor Menninger, and you're listening to Two Nice Jewish Boys.
About 2 months ago, after October 7th and the outbreak of the Israel-Gaza war, a poll was conducted in the United States. Many of you may remember this because the results were pretty shocking. While most Americans support Israel and view Hamas and its actions as genocidal, young Americans 18 to 24 don't quite agree. At least they're not so straightforward about it. 51% responded that Israel should be ended and given to Hamas and the Palestinians. 60% believed that Hamas's massacre was justified due to Palestinian grievances. What's more shocking is that 66% of Americans 18 to 24 thought Hamas's actions on October 7th were genocidal, which, if you think about it, means that a big chunk think genocide against the Jews is legitimate. I guess not surprising after we saw the questioning of Ivy League presidents by Congress. The reality of anti-Semitism, though, goes beyond people's hearts and minds, unfortunately. Over the course of the last 6 months since October 7th, there has been a sharp rise in anti-Semitic incidents, with the ADL reporting a 360% spike back in January. And 90% of them, U.S. Jews, feel this uptick, according to a study done by Pew Research Center. Now, American Jewish organizations are combating this phenomenon, and that's to be expected. What's less expected is an American Muslim organization fighting the rise in anti-Semitism. Joining us today is Dan Kahn, a U.S. Army veteran and deputy director of the Muslim American Leadership Alliance, MALA. MALA is dedicated to empowering individual freedoms, fostering interfaith connections, and combating hate in all its forms. Today, Dan will shed light on MALA's support for the Jewish community, as well as his recent insights shared at the Combat Anti-Semitism Movement panel, where he outlined proactive steps the Muslim community can take to combat anti-Semitism. We are honored to have Dan with us as we explore the American Muslim community's role in building a future where understanding triumphs over division. Join us as we delve into these possibilities for hope and solidarity in these challenging times. Thank you so much, Dan, for joining us.
And for reaching out.
Of course, that was a beautiful introduction. God, yeah, I really have a voice for radio. That's fantastic.
I'm happy to be here. Too.
I've heard that one before, but it's fantastic being here. And thank you for allowing me to speak with you guys about how we can help, how we can bridge the gap. And what I always say is we have to listen. We have to empathize and listen to each other. So I hope we can, you know, really do that.
100%. So like, when did you exactly decide to start tackling anti-Semitism as part of your role within the Muslim American Leadership Alliance?
Well, it goes back way before the October 7th attacks. They're terrible, but anti-Semitism has been deeply rooted in all different cultures across the United States and the whole world. And it goes back thousands of years. And so MALA was only founded in 2016 in Chicago. So we don't go back that far. But since our conception, our president was dedicated to fighting anti-Semitism herself. Her name is Zainab Khan. And just like her, I grew up around Jewish communities, around Jewish people. I'm from New York City myself. So I grew up right next to a synagogue. And those were the kindest, most wonderful people that I have ever met. And they really took care of us. They looked out for us. And I was a really little kid back then. And, you know, they made sure we played the right way. They made sure we didn't run into the street. They never called the cops on us because we were always playing around the synagogue, like climbing over stuff. But they were so nice. And they really showed me what inclusivity is about. It's about you know, having these diverse neighbors who you respect. You might not agree with what they're saying or what they believe, but you respect them. So I grew up with that sentiment. And I joined the military a little bit later, and I was the only Muslim person a lot of people had met. They were like, hey, I've never met a Muslim person. I've never met someone from Pakistan. And I was like, cool. Like, I have a billion friends at home who are like white, Jewish, black, and it's so diverse in New York City. I've never met someone who had never met a Muslim person. So to me, that was crazy. We had a Jewish chaplain in my battalion, and he was the only Jewish person a lot of them had ever met. So that, seeing that and the questions people had, they had a lot of questions for myself, for him. They asked me questions about his faith. And I'm like, I can answer a lot of this because we're Abrahamic and the Quran and Torah are so similar. Every time I talk to a Jewish person, it's always about our similarities, not our differences. So that really brought me to Mala. And I saw there was a giant need for people to speak out against anti-Semitism that are Muslim. Like, we need to show that you can be Muslim and still live with Jewish people. It doesn't need to be constant fighting. And there's a lot of misconceptions that I've seen since I started with Mala in the Muslim community about anti-Semitic remarks that they don't know are anti-Semitic. Like, oh, Jews control the banks. Well, a lot of Jewish people work in finance. We have to look at American history. And when Jewish people immigrated to the United States, especially in the late 1700s, 1800s, banking in that form, it really didn't exist. And Jewish people had a community where they were able to utilize that. They were able to utilize their community to gather and obtain wealth without losing it to nonsense, spending money where they didn't need to spend it. And that helped develop the entire US economy. So we have to look at it in that context, not in the context that they control all the world's banks, because they don't. And then when you look at media, why are so many actors Jewish? Well, because in the early 1900s, when videos, movies, stuff like that were taking off, it was seen as a very low tier job. It was a job people didn't want to do. And things like acting, producing movies were seen as trash jobs that like only low tier people could get. And Jewish immigrants coming over were like, oh, no one wants to hire us. Everyone hates us. What jobs can we do? The jobs we're going to be able to get are stuff in the movie industry. And that helped build it. That helped make Hollywood what it is today. That's why so many actors embrace their Jewish faith. We have to understand the history that goes behind it. And it's educational stuff like this that I use to educate Muslim communities. Like, hey, we don't need to say anti-Semitic things. We just need to understand the history, and that is what makes it great, that the Jewish people are there to help everyone that they come in contact with. They're not some lizard people from outer space who are here to dominate the world. They're literally just put into a situation against their will, and they made the best of it. And they do that every single time. And it's because they did it so long ago that they're deeply ingrained in American society and in the world society. So hopefully that wasn't too much of a ramble, but yeah, hope that came out coherently.
No, at all. That was very great.
But what does it look like? Can you explain a little bit more about you going to communities and what kind of communities and how do people react to your lectures? What ages do you talk to?
Do you speak mostly to Muslims?
It differs. Usually it's a shift between Muslim communities and Jewish communities. I want to say it depends on the season, but it just ebbs and flows. Sometimes I'm speaking to college age Muslim youths at a community college or somewhere in the city. Other times I'm speaking one-on-one with Jewish people, and seeing how they connect in their community, how they themselves fight Islamophobia in their community, and what we can do to fight Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, how they're connected. It really goes back and forth. Most recently, I did one with Abraham Hamra, and we made a little reel together, and that was us speaking about the hatred that both of our communities get, the anti-Semitism that's ingrained in Muslim society, unfortunately, and the Islamophobia that some Jewish people possess. And it's both based on a lack of education about the other person's culture or religion, and they don't hold real merit. They don't represent what real Jewish and Muslim people are about.
In the lectures, how do they look like when you talk to these people? What are the reactions? Did you get hate, threats?
So we do get hate. I'm not going to call the haters out by name because it's not right to, you know, respond to hate with hate. But I understand where they're coming from. They come from a place that lacks a little bit of empathy. And, you know, I've been in a position like that before. When I was younger and, you know, my frontal lobe didn't develop as clearly. So these people usually just attack us on social media. Muslim people. I'm assuming teenagers or young adults, because older people don't have the energy for it. They call us Zionists. They called me most recently a Danny the Zionist or Zionist Danny. And I was like, cool, like that's my nickname now. So whether or not I was doing stuff with MALA, which is the Muslim American Leadership Alliance, I would be a Zionist in their eyes because my girlfriend is Jewish and we celebrate Hanukkah. And we've been celebrating Hanukkah for many years. That to them in their eyes makes me a Zionist. They've attacked our Instagram posts where I'm making latkes. My girlfriend's grandparents came over and taught us how to make latkes because they're a little bit older. We want to save the recipe because their latkes are delicious. The way her granddad makes them, absolutely delicious.
Can you share a secret with us?
I would love to, but I don't know it myself. But they just showed us. They're like, hey, you just blend this with that. You have the potatoes. You cut them like this, and then you blend them.
You have it on your Instagram.
Yeah, the video is on the Instagram. I don't think we shared the recipe on Instagram, but nice. But the video is up there. And they were like,
this is why Islamophobia is so prominent, because mm-hmm. You tease latkes on Instagram and don't share the recipe.
Yeah, we need to share it. It's so good. I don't know what about how. The granddad, like what he does, but they're so good. And I even got like the rest of the batter that was left over in the bowl, and I made a giant latke like the size of my head. And grandma was like, I just call them grandma and grandpa. That makes me a Zionist too, I guess. But like, I see them as my own grandparents.
No, you called them tate and bubbe, then you'd be a Zionist.
I should start doing that. But like, they're like, oh, it's not going to work. You're not going to be able to flip it. It's not going to cook properly. But, you know, like, go ahead. And I was like, yeah, sure. Let's try it. And it worked. Perfect. Perfect crust. Fully cooked on the inside. It was just huge. And that was the first one I had. I was like, for that night, I was like, I'm going to get this out the way, because if not, it's going to get really cold really fast. So that was the one I ate for that night. And then we had a million. We made so many. But without going off on a tangent too much about that, they believe that just because I embrace Jewish culture, that I'm not actively fighting Jewish people, that it makes me a Zionist. During the video with Abraham Hamra, I spoke about how out of context, the Palestinian or pro-Palestine protests are anti-Semitic. And out of context, that's all they use. All these Muslim pages that hate me, they're like, oh, look at Danny the Zionist saying the protests are anti-Semitic. I love the protests. I think protest more. We need them. Absolutely. We need peace. And protesting is a perfect way to help people understand that. But where I see them as anti-Semitic that they didn't put into context, but it's in the video, is when you attack synagogues, Jewish communities, and Jewish individuals with the protests. When we do that, they become anti-Semitic. They had an issue with that, unfortunately. Our haters didn't like
that. I want to stop you for a second. And first of all, I want to like commend you for finding common ground. I agree. I think that like on the face of it, I don't see it. So I don't see it as an impossible future where Jews and Muslims live happily side by side. I don't know if I see it in the next 10 years or in the next 200 years, but I do see a day in which, because I feel like there is some common ground, you know, coming from a religious background myself. We were always taught that as a Jew, you're allowed to actually pray in a mosque, but not in a church, because of the Trinity, and it's like proximity to idolatry. Whereas in Islam, there's very clearly one God, and so I feel like as a faith, we're much closer to each other. I do commend that, and I think that's the first step to find it. Like when you're trying to bring people closer and to find pathways to like to partnership and collaboration and peace ultimately. But I do want to get down to like sometimes in order to actually make progress, you need to deal with the issues. And I want to talk, because you mentioned Zionism. So I want to ask you about like one of the big, I think, questions at the core of the anti-Semitic, you know, discourse or the anti-Semitic debate today is anti-Zionism anti-Semitism? So I want to ask you, like, when they call you a Zionism, are you like, no, I'm not a Zionist? How do you perceive Zionism? And do you think that you can be anti-Zionist and not be anti-Semitic?
That's a really difficult question, but
it's a tough one. It's a tough one, but we like to do tough ones.
Yeah, but I don't, you know, the thing is, you know, there's a very strong belief that the Jewish people belong in Israel. And a lot of people have cited passages in the Quran. I'm not too familiar with them, but it says where, you know, Jewish people belong in the land of Israel. That's written in a lot of holy texts. It's not only just the Torah saying for Jewish people to go to Israel. I think, you know, a lot of Jews themselves separate Zionism and Judaism, but I think they go hand in hand. And I don't get upset when people call me a Zionist. I don't fight it. I don't deny it, because at this point, it's just, it used to mean something else. It used to mean maybe even a few years ago, it used to mean a Jewish person that hated Islam, that wanted to kill every Palestinian possible and take over all of Israel. That is what it used to mean. And now people on like the Muslim side especially have tossed that word around so much that it's lost meaning. When they call somebody like me a person who celebrates Hanukkah because their life partner, the person they love, is Jewish, so now I'm a Zionist, even though I support the people of Palestine and their struggle. I want peace in the Middle East. I want Jews and Muslims to live equally and happily without any conflict from either side. I want the terrorism to end. I want the hostages released. But on the other side, I want, you know, the Israeli military to be like, hey, let's take a step back. Let's, be more accountable. Let's not be so rash in how we execute projects or missions. I'm from the military, so I understand that there's a big issue with civilian casualties in a time of war, and it's terrible, but it does happen. And you know, I believe the Israeli military should work on that, but I believe Hamas should release the hostages and cease to exist because they're a terrorist organization. So I feel like I'm getting off on a tangent.
No, not at all.
Yeah, The Zionist remarks and the meaning of Zionism, I believe, is lost because people have used it so much to describe anyone they don't agree with. They don't agree with me because I'm multicultural. I embrace different cultures that are part of my life. I can't just ignore them. I've been to so many dinners with my, you know, my future in-laws, like so many Jewish, I've worn a kippah. I've read Jewish prayers, which I'm not sure if I remember the name of which holiday, but like I've read Jewish scripts like out loud at the dinner table with them wearing a kippah. And I'm a Muslim. Like, I believe in the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And like the Quran, I've read the Quran millions of times in Arabic. And
you're fluent in Arabic.
I'm not fluent. I can just read it because as kids, we're forced to read it, even if we can't understand it, which I think is a shame. I wish I could speak and read Arabic because I think that would be amazing for communication.
Not unlike, sadly, by the way, not unlike Jewish kids in Europe, in, you know, for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
They were forced to read the Bible, not really understanding 100%.
Yeah, so my main point is Zionism has lost its meaning and people defined it as something else a few years ago. Now it's used to describe everybody under the sun, and it's unfortunate. People that want peace are Zionists now.
I don't think, though, that Zionism ever meant... I do have to, like... what I think is correct, what I think is a mistake. I don't think Zionism was ever kill all the Palestinians and take over all the land. I think Zionism was returning to the Jewish homeland.
Of course, yes.
Yeah. And so I think it was always, I mean, I don't know. I see Zionists in the last 150 years, right? It mm-hmm. sprouted up in the middle of the 19th century. I see Zionists all throughout history as not like, you know, warmongering or anything like mm-hmm. that, but it's people who are seeking to make a land for the Jews. And I do, obviously there's this conflict going on in the Middle East with the Palestinians and the Jew and the Israelis, or the Arabs and the Israelis, because sometimes it goes beyond just Palestinians. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I feel like, I wonder, when you do your outreach and you speak to communities, and you said, you mentioned you guys get hate, but it's mostly online. So when you're speaking to communities, when you're speaking to Muslim students in universities, you don't get backlash. Like, it's not an uphill battle. It's not like people are like, who is this guy talking to us about, you know, Israel and Jews and whatever.
No. Not in person. It's not an uphill battle. Also, the definition of Zionism, I want to make it clear, that's not the true definition. That's the social media, the far gone Islamist, Muslimist, whack job people on Instagram who want to attack us. That's the definition that they used. It's like, oh, kill all the Palestinians. That's not Zionism. Yeah, that's just their definition, and now their definition has changed to a broader sense to encompass everybody. But yeah, Zionists have just been people who wanted to return to Israel that believe people belong in Israel. But the social media people have bastardized it to mean.
It's
okay. I should have made it more clear. Yeah. But in person, at these little events, these little talks, it's usually very like-minded people that want to engage with us. It's people that want to hear us out. It hasn't been an uphill battle in that sense. People have been very accepting. I think it's just a very loud minority of extremism where people are like, we don't want peace. We want to not listen to anybody who supports Jewish people. That's just really an online thing. People in person are a lot nicer.
So you never felt threatened for your life?
No, thankfully not. And
your Jewish girlfriend?
People like, leave her alone. That's the thing.
Afraid.
Yeah, we're not afraid. And the thing is,
I thought you meant that maybe he feels threatened by his Jewish girlfriend.
No. Because the Jewish girlfriend is, you know, Very worrying.
Yeah. The thing is, when I say these things, it's never people attacking the Jewish people that I work with. Like, people aren't attacking Abraham Hamra in the same sense that they're attacking me. They don't attack my girlfriend. It's Muslim people who hate the fact that I'm a Muslim speaking out against terrorism, against Hamas, against the violence, despite that I'm on the side for peace that wants Palestinians and Israelis to live peacefully. That's really what I want. And they don't attack anybody else. They only attack other Muslims. They don't go after the people attacking me aren't the ones going after Jewish people for some reason. It's like, they don't care. They're like, oh, Jewish people, like, we'll leave them alone. They're worried about me. They posted this on one of their Instagram stories a few days ago, where my friend Abraham was like fighting against them in like their comments or their messages. And they told him, we're not worried about you. We're worried about the person to your left claiming to be a Muslim. And I'm like, see, like, they don't care. They don't have the courage to listen to their own message, where they're like, take up arms. No, they just want to attack people that are on a mission for peace, especially from their own side.
Yeah.
And I have to ask you a little bit about October 7th, about Hamas, because as a Muslim, you know the fanatic side of Islam, and you must be familiar with Hamas ideology. So were you surprised when you saw what happened on October 7th?
So coming from a combination of like a military background and a Muslim background, when I combined the two, I would say I wasn't surprised. It was a matter of time that Hamas did that. Terrorist organizations work up the courage to do that now and again. It's a terrible thing what they did. And it's because of them that this conflict was started and ramped up to what it is now. And I really wish that they hadn't done that. They hurt innocent people and they still hold innocent people. I honestly wasn't too surprised. I wish it didn't come to that. I wish that didn't happen. That's okay, go ahead.
What did Islam, where in Islam do they fight? Because they're very, I just read an interesting article. I don't remember if it's in Haaretz, but like the Hamas fanatics, they're very religious. Oh, it was an article with a guy who was the dentist in the 90s in prisons where Hamas and Fatah were held captive, right? He was their dentist, and later he became an intelligence officer in the prison services, because as a dentist they would open up to him. So he talked to everyone, including Sinwar, okay? And when he was asked to differentiate between Hamas operatives and Fatah operatives, he said you could tell the difference in the teeth, because Hamas operatives are so zealous to them cleansing and ceremonial traits are extremely important, in hygiene also. And he described like, and thus also their ideology, their commitment to the cause, was much fiercer than the Fatah operatives. So as someone who knows the Muslim culture and religion, what in Islam, where in Islam do they find the justification for what they did?
For the justification for the attacks?
For the attacks and the general ideology that...
I'm not sure.
The Jews.
I'm not. There are some problematic hadiths that were written, I want to say, out of context and interpreted incorrectly. But I, unfortunately, I'm not an Islamic scholar or expert, so I can't help you there. But it's really a bastardization of the religion that they're using and interpreting incorrectly. I don't know what the specific scripts are, but yeah, it's not right. It's not a religion of hate.
How would you explain it that in many mosques in Europe, in America, you see specifically in Islam a tendency to go to the extreme? Or is it a miss? Is it not a truthful statement?
I think that's something that we need to work on in the communities to address how these things are coming about. So it's a combination of the religion with politics. So these groups are insurgencies because they have a political agenda that they want to enforce on people against their will. And this political agenda, they use religion to kind of brainwash people into doing what they want. They know that people strongly believe in their faith, and they use that against them. And they use that to further whatever political agenda they want for the current regime. It's really politics that's ruined it.
I want to kind of continue Noor's question. There have been in the past claims held up by polls and stuff, but I don't know the accuracy of stuff. I just want to take your take on it. But I think there was the famous kind of debate on, I think it was Bill Maher, Sam Harris had this bit where he was talking about concentric circles of radicalization or extreme views. And he said that in, most people think that in Islam, there's like, okay, they're differentiating between the radical Islamists and all of Muslims by saying that there's these radicals that just want to kill everybody and take over the world. But most Muslims are just peacing. And his claim was that that's false. That if you look at the Muslim community globally, there's like, they're not all willing to go on a plane and blow themselves up, but there is more radicalization, meaning there's maybe it's the tip of the tip that will commit terrorism, acts of terrorism. But then after that, there's more people that support those. And then if you go out, there's more people that hold sort of extreme or primitive ideologies, like that homosexuals should be incarcerated, killed. And then one circle out is that they should be incarcerated. And one circle out is that they're, and so like more extreme views are sort of more normal in Muslim society. I wonder if you think that that's a misrepresentation and that's not how you see it, or do you agree with that and think that sort of your, because you seem to me like a kind of a liberal guy, like do you see yourself at the fringe of Islamic society? And if you do agree with it, how do you think that that can be combated?
In a lot of ways, I do agree with. I've seen it growing up where older people had that sentiment. I think it, does represent, unfortunately, a lot of people. And, it comes down to a lack of education. They're not as well educated or ingrained with different communities. But I have seen that. And I can say I've seen that. It's a terrible thing to see and to experience. It is being gradually phased out as younger Muslims are seeing stuff for how it is. They're meeting gay people and seeing that the gay people aren't literally the devil. They're seeing Jewish people and they're like, oh, this person doesn't hate me. So younger people are really coming around, and they've started, leading the charge against sentiments like that. It's really the older population who has these old ideas, again, put down onto them politically so that those people can stay in charge when they put down minorities like gay people, or when Jewish people were minorities in Arabic countries and they were put down and still are in Arabic countries. It's again comes down to politics. That's how those people stay in charge. They keep the majority of people brainwashed with these horrible beliefs of extremism, and it is something that I've seen. But thankfully, we're coming around, and it's about time that we come around and join the rest of the world and respecting differences and accepting smaller minority communities like gay people.
I appreciate that perspective, but I wonder if, first of all, I appreciate the sentiment that like you want to see the Muslim community come out of this. I wonder, A, if what you just said is true maybe about American Muslims, but there's, you know, American Muslims, I don't know the size of the community, but I'd say it's probably a couple million. And whereas the Muslim community globally is, what, a billion? So like you have Indonesia and the whole Arab world and like massive amounts of Muslims across the world, where I wonder if across, like in the United States, they have this opportunity to grow up. And then you say the older generation, what I think to me, it sounds like their parents or their grandparents. So like a lot of this education is happening in the home. So in America, maybe they have the opportunity to grow up within the wider context of a liberal society and then meet gay people and Jews and not Muslims, not adherent Muslims outside of their home and kind of get liberalized, quote unquote. But you know, hundreds of millions of Muslims around the world don't, and isn't the problem really in the education that's happening in the home? And again, I don't think that Islam has to be taught this way. I think, like you mentioned before, there's hadiths that can be agreed with or disagreed with. There's a whole debate over it, right? Because hadiths are like opinions, that they're like stories told about what Muhammad taught by other people. And some people say, yeah, that's true, but that's not true. So I don't think it has to be taught like this, but I feel like parents are teaching their kids to believe in these things. Is that not the case?
That really is the case. I've seen that firsthand, where parents of my Muslim friends held racist and homophobic beliefs. But when Muslim kids are younger, they're, you know, taught, listen to your parents, only to your parents. So they really grow up with that until they experience things for themselves and see that the world isn't really like that. And I think the Muslim population across the world really is coming along. The extremists and the people in like the really small bubble at the top where they're hold really terrible views, I think around the world it's shrinking. And even in the Middle East, I've heard people complain about it in Muslim communities where places like Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, where they're becoming westernized and they're turning to the devil. But to them, that's a bad thing because they're progressing. They're accepting different communities into their own. So I think the global community of Muslims around the world is changing. It's taking a little bit of time. We have a lot of catching up to do globally, but It's really coming along. We've seen it. We see a lot of stuff on social media, especially of people living together harmoniously in Arabic countries. We have to remember that sometimes the most vocal people are a tiny minority of extremists who, when they speak, it sounds like they're speaking for everybody, and they're like, hey, we hate gays or we hate Jews, but the global Muslim community really is progressing. I can definitely say that. In my opinion, I really see them developing more as we have more access to technology. They don't have to meet a Jewish person. Now they could just be friends with one on Facebook and be like, oh, look, we have the same political beliefs, the same ideology, the same religion. So thanks to, you know, the availability of education, that they're really coming along. Hopefully we see people of my generation having kids of their own and teaching their kids that to be more accepting and to build bridges for peace. I think globally we're really coming along. I don't think that the representation for hate and the beliefs of the older generation really represent us globally.
I wonder if you can share with us a story where you managed to de-radicalize someone in one of your, you know, someone who came to you after a lecture or you talked with on Instagram or I don't know, and you completely changed their worldview, their perspective.
Yeah, I was arguing with somebody on Instagram, as people do, unfortunately. I hate it. A lot of times I just, if I really think they're super far gone or if I'm tired, I just block them and it's that easy. But I was speaking to someone and he called me a Zionist. And again, you know, like what does that even mean nowadays in terms of social media? Who, do Jewish people belong in Israel? Perfect. I celebrate Hanukkah. Cool. So he was calling me a Zionist, things like that. And he had some really anti-Semitic remarks to make. And let me check my phone. Let me look at his messages if I can find them, because it was a few days ago.
Sure.
Oh, so many
later
messages.
We're gonna ask you to find the latkes recipe as well.
My girl, then I'll be in danger for my girlfriend. Then
yeah,
I'll be in danger.
Then you might be feel threatened by her.
Yeah. Okay, I actually reached out to him first because he left a comment. He left a comment on one of our posts on the Mala page, and I said, "Hey, name redacted. I understand why you would leave your comments on our posts. It's a very difficult time. It's very decisive, especially on social media." This person says, "Why are you working with Zionists and making a video with a man whose videos have been slandering Muslims and Palestinians?" Then he talks about how I'm South Asian. And then for some reason, he's racist towards South Asians. And I confront him about that later. I told him, I'm like, "You're right. I can only speak for myself and the organization and the community that we represent, not Muslims as a whole. We have to see why they think that way," referring to Islamophobia. We have to ask them why they hold these beliefs and to do what we can to bridge the divide so we can live peacefully. We could do three things. We could ignore them, bully them, or in best opinion, speak with them with empathy and try to understand why they hold these beliefs. And after speaking with so many Jewish people, I've helped them to understand that Islam is a religion of peace and unity. And I know you and I disagree on the approach, but I respect your opinion. And yeah, he's like, "You know, I don't like what you're doing or how you're doing it." But like, he agreed with me. He said, "Yeah, like, he's going to stay away from Jewish people, but he respected that I was doing things the way I'm doing because it's still educating people. It's still showing them that not all Muslims are evil, are these terrorists who want to go out and murder innocent people, that we're just people trying to live our lives, trying to work day to day." And his response to my messages was like, "Hey, cool. I don't agree either, but, you know, live and let live."
Amen.
Amen. Amen. I really hope that your efforts yield fruits. I hope that, you know, we live to see a day where we're able to see, you know, much, much, much more peace between Muslims and Jews. I want to turn to, you mentioned that you work with the Jewish communities to battle Islamophobia as well. So can you tell us a bit about like what's like the worst cases or where, you know, some interesting, interactions that you've had within Jewish communities around Islamophobia?
Yeah, it's great. So I, kind of blend in with Arabic Jews. So like my friend Abraham, who I call my friend, and I'm going to be called a Zionist for calling him my friend. But again, like, it's so crazy. I think of that every time. You can't say anything without getting canceled nowadays. But so We look very similarly, so I blend in. So I go to a lot of events with Arabic Jews, and I'm not going to name their organization, but I was at one of their events, and I was sitting next to two very nice ladies. And the speaker, who I'm friends with, he said, we work with a lot of Muslim organizations, and we get a lot of hate for that. But, you know, we still work with them to show solidarity. And I'm like, hey, look, that's me. I didn't say that out loud. But then the lady one person over from me said, you can't trust a Muslim, like, to her friend. And she was like, she probably didn't know that my friend who was speaking was talking about me being there for my organization at this Jewish event. And like, and then, you know, I was like, okay, cool. Like, social media is all about canceling people and it sucks. And I don't believe in cancel culture. It comes from such an immature, horrible place to cancel somebody. So why don't we practice something like empathy? And in cases like the October 7th attacks, what people in Palestine are suffering through, we have to practice extreme empathy because it's so hard to relate with people. Especially if, you know, I'm in the United States, I'm not in Israel, even though I want to visit Israel one day. And so many of my Jewish friends are like, I'm taking you, we're going. But that's a different story. You know, we practice extreme empathy. We practice empathy for people we don't agree with. And I didn't agree with her. But what was she talking about? Like, why would she say you can't trust a Muslim? It was literally in the event that I was at, like, where, you know, it's, the event was about that. It was about forgotten survivors of specific events and their stories, and it covered a little bit of October 7th. And in the event, they talked about the horrible conditions that Jewish people had to live through in Arabic countries, where they were ostracized. They were probably lucky if they were ostracized because they were also gravely humiliated. There were parades humiliating Jewish people. They were cut off from their loved ones and friends and families. And there were a lot of cases, many, many cases where Muslim neighbors and friends turned on Jewish people. Like, they were friends with Jewish people and they just turned on them. They gave them up to the authorities. They helped kick them out of the country. There are, thankfully, a lot of stories where Muslim people helped them escape. But the fact that they had to escape at all is an injustice. So, like, why would she say you can't trust a Muslim? When I practice empathy, I see that she's probably heard many, many accounts of close loved ones, her parents, her grandparents, who were like humiliated at the hands of people they trusted, Muslim friends and loved ones that they considered family, who betrayed them, and they had to leave their homes where they lived for generations. It's terrible. So when I practice empathy, put myself in her shoes, I would think the same thing. If somebody betrayed me like that, and if I heard stories growing up my whole life that these people betrayed us, these people that we loved and lived with betrayed us, I wouldn't have the same sentiment. So
yeah.
Go ahead.
So between the lines, I can deduce that you expect also Israelis to sympathize with Gazans, for example?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Practice empathy on all sides. And it's when we disagree the most that we should practice the most empathy. Be like, why do we disagree with them? Why are Gazans can empathize with Israelis. Israelis can empathize with Gazans. Let's put ourselves in somebody else's shoes, see how they're living, how they're feeling. And not only in that moment, but like I was saying about the history, like go back years, like why would they feel like that? Maybe, but
where do you draw the line? Like, yeah, I can take this, stretch it, excuse me, Holocaust alert, but I could go to the Jews in the ghetto and say, tell them you need to empathize with the Nazis. So where's the red line here?
There absolutely should be a red line. I'm one of those people that believes, you know, it has to stop somewhere. I don't think that, you know, it sucks. You shouldn't be allowed to do whatever you want. So I think there should be a red line, and it should stop at like extremism. We should see and understand why they're doing that, but it doesn't mean we have to accept what they're doing. We can see and put ourselves into somebody like Hamas, put ourselves into their shoes, see why they're doing it. But we absolutely, by no means, do we need to agree with them or support them at all. Just understand why they're doing it, but then, you know, keep our own beliefs and opinions. Be like, okay, cool, I understand why they're doing it. It's still not right. It's still not moral. It's not just. So with the Nazis, you know, like, see why they were doing it. Perfect. We see why. Horrible beliefs, terrible atrocities, the worst the world has seen in such horrible, horrendous ways. As a kid, I read several books on the Holocaust when I was like a really little kid. So like I had a very vivid imagination, as kids do. So I hate everything that happened. And there should be a line. And the line is, we don't have to support them. We don't have to agree with them. But we should try to see what their reasoning is. But we have no means. The line is, we have to by no means support what they believe, why they believe it, or what they're doing.
I think, though, you know, it's clear to me, like, I think I'm a pretty sensitive guy. I don't know if my wife would agree, but I'm a pretty sensitive guy. I'll cry.
I also cry.
I'll cry pretty much like give me some cheesy rom-com and I'm liable to cry. I'm a pretty sensitive guy. Like
you
I cried at The Office.
Oh my god, I did cry.
At the last episode of The Office, are you kidding?
Yeah.
That thing is
when Michael proposes to Holly in the office and there's like candles everywhere. I didn't cry, but I got close and my girlfriend cried a little bit. But
when Michael leaves and Jim says goodbye to him. I mean, come on. If you don't cry in that scene, you're not
worse than Hamas.
But no, but I honestly, now getting back to Hamas, I'm a pretty empathetic dude. I think I have a high EQ. And I find it pretty simple to understand why Gazans feel the way they feel and why they believe what they believe. Again, I think a lot of it has to do with education within the home and how they're raised from a very young age. I think a lot of it has to do with the context within which they live and they are brought up in, you know, pretty shitty conditions. And then they're taught to blame that shittiness on Israel. And then they do, when they meet Israelis or Jews, they often meet soldiers who are not, you know, obviously the nicest of people in certain circumstances because of the circumstances. Again, I don't blame the soldiers. I'm saying that when you meet a soldier, usually behind enemy lines and you're the enemy, it's not going to be a pleasant encounter. So I don't find it difficult to understand them and to empathize with them. And I think my qualm is like a lot of my issue is that it's a dangerous game. And you see this with this is my problem with empathy. You see it with a lot of Israeli leaders, actually. Famously, Ehud Barak said, you know, if he had grown up a Palestinian, he would have blown himself up on a bus as well, or he would have been a terrorist. I don't remember exactly his words. And that's, I think, where extreme empathy sometimes takes you. It's like you're so empathetic. And there's a lot of philosophers, modern philosophers, who warn against this. Like if you're not really strong, if you lend your hand to the weak, you're often pulled down under with them. So that's what I'm saying, is that I think that sometimes you need to you need to take a step back and put empathy aside and just remember what right and wrong is, and then you're less liable to get to questionable places. That, and you know, I wonder if you think that there's a boundary to how much empathy, like, you know, maybe we're not, maybe we shouldn't venture off into the world of empathy always, because we're liable to get lost and then find ourselves not only empathizing and commiserating, but maybe even supporting the evil.
You know, I agree. It's a really thin line between empathizing and supporting. So, and if someone's moral beliefs are true, then it would be really easy to cross that line and end up supporting the wrong side. It's a really dangerous territory. And it has to be, you know, extreme empathy to be able to relate to somebody on the fringes, somebody who would be a part of a terrorist organization. That has to be super extreme, extreme empathy. And I would hope that, you know, people have the moral fortitude, the moral beliefs and structure and support in their lives to know that, you know, what the other people, what Hamas and terrorist organizations are doing is bad. And yeah, you know, I think we should be careful. We should be careful with empathy. It's a tool, like a lot of things, like how a rifle is a tool, how a screwdriver is a tool. Empathy is also a tool. These podcasts are tools. Like, people can use this to learn and develop themselves and bridge gaps in their communities. But empathy is a tool we need to be very careful with. And I agree with you. I think we should be cautious with how much we do empathize with people. And we shouldn't be afraid to do it, but we should remember to keep our morals in check. We need to keep ourselves in check. We need to keep our friends and families in check when they stray or they have questions. If somebody, you know, if a younger person starts empathizing with Hamas and they come to me with a question, it's important not to yell at them or make them feel bad. It's, you know, it's our duty to help our friends and families and community stay on the moral path, to remember what's right and wrong. And I think if the community is in the right place, if the person's heart is in the right place, they can empathize with whoever they need and then come back to who they are. But I agree with you. It is a slippery slope sometimes.
Yeah.
Okay. Duncan, thank you so much. You're on social media. How can people find you?
Yeah, at Mala National. We're all over the internet at Mala National,
Twitter,
Facebook. Yep. It's the at symbol. Hopefully I did that right on the screen. M-A-L-A and then National. I'm really bad at spelling. If I spell it here and I screw it up, I'm not gonna be able to live it down. Yeah, Mala National. We love working with Jewish communities. We love working with Muslim communities. Thank you so much for having me. I loved talking to you guys. You guys are fantastic.
Astor, you're a really inspiring guy.
Yeah,
of course.
Definitely commend. Yeah, commend your efforts. Commend your work. Keep doing what you're doing. Thank you so much.
When you're in Tel Aviv, hit us up.
Absolutely. Hopefully soon. One day soon. I plan on being there.
Amazing. Usually we offer a beer, but we can't offer you a beer, but we'll get a coffee or
coffee and latkes.
Oh my god, yes. That'd be amazing.
Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
I think you can still say wish Ramadan Kareem to
Yeah.
Thank you. Of course. All right.
Bye, guys.
Have a good night, guys.